Catholic Family Podcast presents Lent Around the World, daily traditional Catholic meditations read by our friends from across the globe.
The Passion and Death of Our Lord Jesus Christ by the Most Reverend Alban Goodyear. Chapter 8, Part 21, The Morning Trial. It was well after midnight before the assembly in the court of Caiaphas broke up. Of this we have abundant evidence. When Judas left the supper room, it was already quite dark. Therefore, it must have been not earlier than 8 o'clock, according to our reckoning. The supper had continued perhaps for an hour. There had been the walk to the Garden of Gethsemane, a short half hour. The agony is spoken of as lasting at least an hour, probably longer. The betrayal, the capture, the journey back to the courts, first of Annas, then of Caiaphas, could scarcely have taken less than an hour more. Hence, even if we shorten these estimates, the trial before Caiaphas would have begun not earlier than an hour before midnight. The trial itself seems to have lasted some 2 hours. Between the second and third denials of Peter, we are expressly told that there was an interval of about an hour. Jesus, then, would have gone to his prison and the judges to their beds between 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning. What happened during the remainder of that night, we are not expressly told. Many commentators take the insults offered in the court of Caiaphas as an account of the treatment meted out to Jesus during all the early morning hours. It may well have been so, but it would rather seem from the gospel story that what was done by the soldiers and the rabble was done in the sight of the priests and elders, following the example which these leaders set, and with their full approval. Once the sentence had been passed, once the passions of the judges had been let loose, the mob had crowded into the open room from the yard below and had joined in the abuse and confusion. It was only when they had wearied of their sport that the guard at length had led their victim out and consigned him to the narrow cell where he was to await the more formal and final sentence of the court next day. In any case, there could have been but little sleep that night, either for Jesus or for his jailers, or for those most concerned in the tragedy. These last were up betimes. The meetings overnight, with whatever pomp and circumstances Annas and Caiaphas had carried them through, could not, by any reading of the law, be accounted official trials. The law forbade that trials should be held during the night. Therefore, for even a show of legal justice, it was essential that a council should be held in the morning. But, moreover, if they would have their work completed that day, they must set about it early. For the next day was the Pasch, a great Sabbath day, and before it began, that is, before sunset that evening, Jesus of Nazareth must be condemned, not only by themselves but by the Roman court, and put to death, and buried out of sight, then and forever. They came together in the court of Caiaphas as soon as it was day. So well had their plan succeeded in that meeting place, they could well take up the threads where they had laid them down. They gathered in their numbers, that the full weight of their authority might be brought to bear later upon the Roman judge. Since Jesus had been tried and condemned the night before, since the witnesses had been heard and the sentence had been pronounced, there was no need to go back upon the trial. All that was required was a formal sanction of the informal proceedings they had gone through. And straightway in the morning, as soon as it was day, the chief priests and ancients of the people and scribes came together and held a council against Jesus to put him to death. And they brought him into their council, saying, "If thou be the Christ, tell us." It was indeed to them only a formality, but it was necessary, even now, that no mistake should be made. They must act together, they must agree beforehand what should be done. Caiaphas had long since proved to them the end they were to achieve. Last night he had shown them how they might most speedily achieve it. There was no further need of witnesses. Jesus, if he were asked, would condemn himself out of his own mouth. Then they might take him forthwith to the governor, Pontius Pilate. He was one who, with his contempt of the Jews and with the evidence of this court before him, would without doubt grant them their request. Then Jesus could be put away at once, and they could return to their preparations for the Pasch, and could receive the homage due to their rank in the temple, without any further trouble of mind. Indeed, this would be for them a great Sabbath day, with their enemy dead in his tomb. But for Jesus, This morning trial was much more than a formality. The night before, until he had been questioned directly, and that by the high priest himself, he had not deigned to answer anything, for that was not a lawful trial. And only when Caiaphas had spoken as high priest, when he had called upon his prisoner in the name of the living God, had Jesus deigned to give even him an answer. But this morning, all was different. Now, with all their show of formalities, this was the true judicial court, and these were responsible judges. Last night, one overweening man alone had swayed the rest, and in a heated moment, by a single adroit question, had won from them their sentence. Now, the sentence would be passed of the court's own accord, without the excuse of passion or haste, deliberately and with full knowledge. Therefore, as was his duty, Jesus would answer them, and his answer would be no less clear to these masters of the law and the prophets than before. But first, he would also warn them. If in his pity he had warned Judas, if he had warned Peter and the others, no less, even at this moment, would he warn these poor men of the evil thing they were about to do, and save them, if he could, from their shame. He would appeal to their common sense of justice. He would ask for that fair dealing which they would grant to any man, and yet were refusing to him. Let them condemn him if they wished, but let them not refuse him the hearing to which he had a right. And he said to them, "If I shall tell you, you will not believe me. And if I shall ask you, you will not answer me, nor let me go." Nevertheless, though they would not hear him, in spite of the storm which he knew his words would arouse, now, more than ever, it was his right and duty to speak. They might not believe him. Indeed, whether they believed or not, they would most certainly condemn him. But they should hear, and that in terms which, from their knowledge of the sacred books, they could not mistake. But hereafter, the Son of Man shall be sitting on the right hand of the power of God. I beheld, therefore, in the vision of the night, and lo, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven. And he came even to the Ancient of Days, and they presented him before him, and he gave him power and glory and a kingdom. And all the peoples, tribes, and tongues shall serve him. His power is an everlasting power that shall not be taken away, and his kingdom shall not be destroyed. From the prophet Daniel. The Lord said to my Lord, "Sit thou at my right hand until I make thy enemies thy footstool. The Lord will send the scepter of thy power out of Sion. Rule thou in the midst of thy enemies. With thee is the principality in the day of thy strength, in the brightness of the saints. From the womb before the day star I begot thee. The Lord hath sworn, and he will not repent. Thou art a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. The Lord at thy right hand hath broken kings in the day of his wrath." From the Psalms. Prophecies such as these were familiar to these men and could not fail to be recalled by the words he used. They were words of majesty, spoken now before the lawful court as they had been spoken before the unlawful court of Caiaphas the night before. The cruelties and hardships of the night had in no way bent him. The long fast and the sleeplessness had not weakened his spirit. In spite of all they did to the body of this man, there was that within which they could not break. From beginning to end, he kept before them all the iniquity of their deed. He kept it unflinchingly before them. He appealed to evidence with which they were familiar. While they brought against him either deliberately false witness or none at all, he brought against them the witness of the prophets, and whom they had always believed. While they affected to judge him, he let them clearly see at every step that in reality, he was their judge. In the end, he would have the last word when he was seated on the right hand of the power of God. Now it was their hour in the power of darkness, and in the blind passion of that hour, they might refuse to look beyond. But the time would come when he would be in his rightful place, and with the power of God would pass sentence upon them. And yet he would not say, he would not even hint what that sentence would be. The Son of Man had come to save the world, not to destroy it, not to condemn, but to win sinners to repentance. And so long as there was hope for even one in that crowd of evil men, he would not even threaten a word of condemnation. He had spared them so often in the past, he would spare them even then. Nay, more, in the past he had upbraided them. They should hear no word of accusation now. The nearer he came to his kingdom, the more he would have pity, even on the blinded folly that did him to death. But these men were not to be beaten either by his forbearance or by his warnings. They hated him, and hatred knows no reason. Hatred will never yield. Let him say what he would, they had learnt from the trial of the night before the test question, the answer to which would prove his doom. For they knew what answer this man would give, who on their own confession but 3 days before was a true speaker, who teachest the way of God in truth. Neither carest thou for any man, for thou dost not regard the person of men. Caiaphas, who long ago had soothed their conscience concerning what they did, had also found for them this further key. They had only to repeat his test. Again, therefore, ignoring what Jesus had just said, as if it had no bearing on the case, as deliberate injustice always will. Then said they all, Art thou then the Son of God? Jesus answered as they wished. He had said all that he had to say in his own defense. It remained only that he should give witness to the truth before this court that alone had the right to ask him and judge him. And he said, You say that I am. The answer was received with the same assumption as that with which it had been received at the trial in the night. These judges had well learnt from their leader how to play their part. Besides, they were in need to hurry with their work. Jesus must be put out of the way before the day was over, and there was much yet to be done. Somewhere that morning, at a preliminary meeting, almost certainly before Jesus had been brought into them, it had been decided to take him to be condemned by the Roman court. No doubt they might themselves have condemned him to be stoned to death for blasphemy, but they recalled that they had attempted this before, on more than one occasion, and always he had escaped them. Moreover, that he should die as a public malefactor and criminal would serve their purpose better than that he should be put to death for blasphemy. Stoning to death might make him a hero. Death for religion's sake might invest him with the halo of a martyr. If they, the Sanhedrin, alone condemned him, when the reaction came, when the city awoke to what had been done, they would have reason to fear the people, as they had so often feared them before. But the death of a public criminal, the degrading death of crucifixion, no man's reputation could survive. Even the law of Moses would bury the name of such a one in oblivion. For when a man hath committed a crime, for which he is to be punished with death, and being condemned to die is hanged on a gibbet, his body shall not remain upon the tree, but shall be buried the same day. For he is accursed of God that hangeth on a tree. And thou shalt not defile thy land, which the Lord thy God shall give thee in possession. The trial was quickly over, yet surely was it the critical moment of the whole story of the Passion. Now, definitely, in a council which could no longer be called illegal or in any way invalid, Jesus was rejected and condemned by the judges of his own people. No wonder they wished to make haste, though conscience no longer troubled them. Yet, the sense of degradation and shame because of what they did hung about them, and the eyes of him whom they had condemned to die followed them about the hall. There was no need now to go through any further form. There was no further need of witnesses. Before the highest court in the land, he had made his confession of guilt, and they could proceed. Then they said, What need we any further testimony? For we ourselves have heard it from his own mouth. There was nothing more to delay them, not even the formalities of the law. Their plans had been carefully laid, and they were free to act at once. The house and council chambers of Caiaphas, where these things had been done, were in the lower part of the city. Fort Antonia, where Pilate kept his court, was at the upper end beyond the temple. All that remained was to take him there and have their sentence formally confirmed and carried out by the Roman governor. If all went as they wished and expected, the sentence would be carried out long before midday. Pilate was a man of moods, and they knew him well, arbitrary in his manifestations of power, with no understanding of Jewish prejudice, contemning and flouting religious form of any kind, a man of the world who had no use for religion, especially for that antiquated ceremonial in which the Jews were steeped. Moreover, he was careless of Jewish life, as became a dominant Roman. And much as the accusers of Jesus hated him for it, yet on this occasion they felt they could use it for their purpose. They had but to show Pilate that they were in earnest and he would yield. They had but to prove to him that unless he yielded there would be trouble in the city, and he would condemn. Pilate was in Jerusalem at that time precisely to keep order in a troubled season, and he would not care, for the sake of a single Jew's life, to add to his worries. There were others to be put to death that day, for executions usually took place before the great festivals, and to add one more to the number would be of little moment to Pilate. Nevertheless, all must be properly staged. The priests and elders were cooler now than they had been the night before, and they knew the importance of first impressions on the judge whom they were now to face. Jesus must be bound again. Everything that could mark their decision as to his guilt must be laid upon him. He must be brought before the Roman judge as an undoubted criminal. Moreover, they must themselves be unanimous in decision and action. A dissentient voice must not be heard. It was still very early in the morning, scarcely 6 o'clock, as we would say. There would be few about at that early hour to protest, even if they wished it. If they hurried with their work, all might be completed before the city awoke to what was being done. For even yet, it must not be forgotten that more than Pilate or his soldiers, those priests and elders feared the people. And the whole multitude of them rose up, and binding Jesus, led him from Caiaphas to the governor's hall, and brought him bound, and delivered him to Pilate, the governor. The streets from the house of Caiaphas to the court of Herod led up through the deep valley which cut the city of Jerusalem in two. On their right, as the accusers with their victim went, towered up the wall of the temple. On their left, also high up above them, was the thronged part of the town, a confusion of palaces and hovels, with the bazaars towards the north. Over their heads, at intervals, stone arches carrying streets joined the city to the temple courts. The road up the valley was a thoroughfare joining north and south little more. Today, it is buried many feet beneath the surface, filled with the debris of ancient Jerusalem when it was beaten flat to the ground, and there was left of the city not a stone upon a stone. It would seem that Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, had been forewarned of what was in store for him that day, and of what would be expected of him. Moreover, the Romans were glad to have the business of litigation done with as soon as possible. Accordingly, even at this early hour, he was awaiting the crowd that gathered round his door. At the northwest corner of the temple wall, the road turned sharply to the right, running along the northern boundary. On the other side, to the north, soon appeared the barracks and courts of the Roman soldiery, with the threatening tower of Antonia raised above them, overlooking, commanding, and threatening, in case of trouble, the court of the temple below. This street was far more narrow than that along which the crowd had come up through the city. It led past the praetorium out to the northeastern gate. In front of the governor's hall, an archway spanned it, connecting the Roman quarters on either side. The stones of that archway are still preserved, spanning the altar of Our Lady of Sion built upon the spot. On ordinary occasions, the accusers with their victim would have gone up the steps leading to the governor's hall and would have pleaded their cause before the Roman judge in the place of justice, where the judge would sit upon his marble throne. But on this occasion, they would not go in. Instead, they handed Jesus over to the Roman guard and demanded that Pilate should come out to them. For the morrow was the Pasch. Even Pilate knew that, or he would not have been at that moment in the city. And the good Jew must be careful that he prepared for the great day with due solemnity. He must not contaminate himself beforehand.
He must do nothing that would make him unclean or guilty in the eyes of the law. But to enter the house of an unbeliever would at any time contaminate him for that day. Much more then must he be careful on a day when ceremonies were to be performed. Therefore, on no account, not even to ensure that in this case of all cases, his end was gained, would he cross the threshold of the unbeliever, Pilate, on this day. He might hate, but outside his own court, he must have due regard to ceremony. He might advocate injustice, but it must be covered by the letter of the law. He might do an innocent man to death. He might commit the most terrible crime that ever man had committed on this earth. Still, if he did what was done, if he conformed the convention, if he claimed on his side the maintenance of law and order and righteousness, whatever crime he did, he might satisfy himself that all was well, and the world that thought with him would applaud. And they went not into the hall, that they might not be defiled, but that they might eat the Pasch.